Chers auditeurs, chères auditrices, bienvenue à Radio Créum et à la balado-diffusion du colloque en mémoire de Jerry Cohen qui a eu lieu à l'Université McGill le 27 novembre 2009. Dear listeners, welcome to Radio Créum and to the podcast of the conference in memoriam of Jerry Cohen that took place at McGill University on November 27, 2009.
Our second pair of papers presentations will be by Jürgen de Vispelare, who is a visitor this year at the Centre de Recherche en Éthique de l'Université de Montréal, and Jacob Levy, who you all know from the Political Science Department here. They arm wrestled earlier, and it was determined that Jürgen would go first.
Does that mean I won or I lost?
I don't know. For you to decide.
Cool. Okay, thanks so much. First of all, you have to kind of keep my time. I have no conception of time, right?
Okay, so how much time do you want me to be keeping you at?
Well, maybe sort of wave something when I'm at 20 minutes.
At 20 minutes, I'll wave.
Start waving very when I'm at 25, something okay. Like that. Okay, cool. Well, first of all, I'm extremely, as Will was saying, humbled to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me. I should say thanks to Daniel for volunteering me. We have to have a chat about voluntary coercion and things like that. Cohen actually writes really interesting stuff about that, so we'll have to pick that up sometime. I mean, like everyone else, I think it's a good point to say a few words about Jerry. I was never a student of Jerry's. I was a student of Brian Berry's, who actually features as one of the minor villains in the rescuing book. The big villain, of course, being Rawls, and then, Brian being his trusted sidekick on the Pareto argument. I have to say that, I always liked a lot of stuff that Brian did, but I think on this one, Jerry really kind of took him out to the cleaners, proverbial cleaners, I'm afraid. But the one thing I always did like about Brian is this very strong attention of, problems in the world and making sure that philosophy sort of applies right away. And of course, interestingly, I mean, Jerry in that book, the rescuing book, is very obvious about, look, we really want to talk about political philosophy as philosophy. And, there might be all sorts of interesting stuff going on in the real world, but we need to kind of backtrack as well. And when we talk about principles of justice, it really has to be philosophical principles. And of course, his main target there, Rawls, I mean, the implication basically being that Rawls kind of misses the fundamental bit. And I think it's Poge in this recent ratio number on Jerry's book who says something like, we should now rename the theory of justice into the theory of regulation, and it probably wouldn't sell as much, which all granted, seems to be right. So in some sense, I mean, the reason I'm saying is that, so my idea was to say something in this paper on, the regulation side in a funny sort of way. I agree with a lot of things that Jerry says on the fundamental principles, but then he does say that, well, there is this other component, but then he doesn't necessarily say much about it. And I kind of like to drag it back in there. So it's an important qualification of what I'm going to say. And I kind of started off saying Cohen in the real world, ? And I do want to say, I mean, anyone who's known Jerry Cohen knows that despite the philosophical rigor, I mean, Jerry was very much in the real world in many other ways. So I don't want to imply that he is one of the armchair people who's just out there and has no commitments whatsoever. Having said that, he did think that these two enterprises, to some extent, they're very worthwhile on their own. And we have to analyze philosophy as philosophy, and we have to analyze real-world activism as real-world activism. And one of the interesting sort of a little anecdote, I was at the conference, the Oxford Center for the Study of Social Justice, their big opening conference, where, it was the star-studded event. All the Oxford people were doing papers, David Miller, Stuart White, Jerry himself. And I think the conference was sort of in line of, what social justice can contribute to, practical issues. And everyone did their papers. And at the end, I sort of asked everyone in the panel, at the end there was a big panel, so you've all given us these sort of big distinctions and things like that. So you claim to be involved in practice. So what practical import does your work really have? And they all kind of sort of started, you know, fiddling away. And it's like, well, you know, until they got down to Jerry. And Jerry basically said, I never said this. You know, I mean, yeah, I'm supposed to give a talk here, but I've always been very, very clear about this is about philosophy. That's all I'm going to say. Anyone else can take it up further on, sort of thing. So, and I always appreciated the very sort of straightforwardness of Jerry. You know, what you see is what you got, and there was just no doubt about it. And the other little anecdote is, I don't know whether anyone else here was at Jerry's valedictorian lecture in Oxford. And I'm not 100% sure, but I think there might be a webcast somewhere floating around. If you want to see what Jerry was like, see that one. I mean, it's basically one of the best philosophical events of years to come, I would imagine. And it's one of the most hilarious events of years to come. I mean, this is, you know, in terms of entertainment value and in terms of genuine philosophy, this is what you really need to see. And then you need to read all the books or the other way around, whatever you want to do. Okay, so that's sort of my, I mean, you know, as I said, I've had the pleasure of meeting Jerry a few times, but I've not really known him all that much. But what I've seen is really absolutely impressive. So anyway, moving on to the paper, such as it is. Just one other qualification. When Daniel initially asked us, he said, well, let's do something informal. I mean, that's just a puzzling thing, you know. You have Cohen and then let's do an informal Cohen. So I wasn't quite sure what to do with this. So I took this to say, well, let's just read the book and give us some vague reflections and don't worry too much about it. Until the man with the radio came up. Because these vague reflections now apparently are going to be kept for posterity. So, you know, so I reserve the right to change my view totally after even the first question, okay, just for the record. Okay, so what is this paper about? This paper is, our paper, reflections, is basically about if you are a person, and I am one of these people who always liked this idea of social institutions, what do you do after you've read Jerry Cohen's Rescuing book? And, you know, and to some extent, this comes down to the question that Dominic was asking to Jones. It's like, well, you know, there's all these sort of reasons we have to like institutions. And the question, in a sense, is, are these sort of purely contingent reasons? I mean, is this just like, well, you know, in the real world, there might be ways in which you can do better? Or might there be some sort of little bit more normative remnant that we can rescue there from Jerry's big, huge criticism? And if so, is that even compatible with what he's actually saying? And so to some extent, I'm going to sort of try and slightly fiddle with that. And it is as tentative as it gets, okay? So just to put that out front there. What I'm going to do is I'll say a few words about Jerry's project, what I think could be the challenge then, and then sort of try and come up with a few conclusions there. So first of all, Jerry Cohen's project in Rescuing Justice and Equality, mostly in part one, but partly in the second part as well, is really about one big goal, which is he wants to rebut the idea largely put forward by Rawls and the Rawlsians, but also other liberal egalitarians, that inequalities are justified or even just as long as they benefit the worst off. Very straightforward point. And Jerry has been working on this in various ways for the past, you know, 20 years. And one of the big arguments, of course, has been always the fact that these inequalities aren't, strictly speaking, necessary. Therefore, you know, all these claims that Brian Berry and Rawls are making, you know, we need to kind of be very, very careful about that, and especially focus on the sort of necessity component of it. But then he makes the further claim, and this is the point I made earlier in Joe's talk as well, is that, well, even if they were, strictly speaking, necessary, which he denies, you know, it doesn't make them unjust, okay? So these are the sort of the two big parts of the book, in a sense. Now, Cohen basically thinks that what he calls standard cases, you know, inequality incentives are unjust, even if they're sometimes necessary. And so what he basically is saying, that inequality incentives, whatever else their status is, simply do not cohere with the principle of justice that states that morally arbitrary factors should not determine the distribution of advantage and disadvantage. That's the key starting point. That's his equality point. Okay? Now, Rawlsians who accept this principle of justice, they too think morally arbitrary factors shouldn't determine this, okay? So Rawlsians themselves accept this principle, but then discard it along the way when they propose difference principle and in its various formulations, okay? And when, therefore, they propose effectively just incentive inequalities. And for Jerry basically is to say that, look, this just doesn't make any sense. So Rawlsians either aren't proper egalitarians and they have to find a different basis, or else if they really do this, they have to basically ditch what they're saying about incentive inequalities in terms of them being just. So it's a fully internal incoherence point. Now, the Rawlsians then object, and this is the big point that I'd like to focus on, which is, well, yeah, Jerry, you're absolutely right, but you're missing one big point, which is Rawls is very clear that this is supposed to be a focus on justice being only for the basic structure and therefore not for anything else. And what you seem to be missing is that, you know, you kind of want to expand this and it's not quite right. So this is the famous, I mean, this is the very fake formulation, of course. This is the famous basic structure objection. Now, if the problem that Cohen basically has is that if the basic structure objection would be right, then, you know, a lot of things that he says don't follow. Therefore, he needs to counter it. And of course, Cohen famously does counter this by saying the following. The basic structure objection is actually invalid because this restriction itself to that Rawls introduces to the basic structure is untenable, given this sort of stated importance of what he calls profound effects of institutions. And the idea is that, and I'll say something more about that later on, the idea is that the basic structure is justified because it has profound effects on, actually on what is not entirely clear, but on justice in a sort of general sense. And what Jerry basically says is he proposes the following dilemma for Rawlsians, and Rawlsians being the broad group of liberal egalitarians taking this view. Either principles of justice apply to the basic structure, but then they also have to apply to other social practices and even personal choices, because these personal choices and other practices are also, you know, have the same profound effects. So if profound effect is your criterion, then it has to expand, or else the principle of justice, you stick with this basic structure restriction, but then you have to drop the profound effect criterion, and then the distinction itself becomes arbitrary, according to Jerry, okay? And if he's right, this is really a dilemma in which the Rawlsians are pinned on either or. And ultimately, you know, they have to kind of give up what they think is their coherent position. So Jerry's conclusion after his attempt, or I think fairly successful attempt, at demolishing the basic structure objection is basically twofold. The first one is that the objection itself is invalid, and therefore he can't be used to rescue his incentive critique. So this is, to some extent, you know, this is his internal debate with the Rawlsians, saying that, look, I think the Rawlsians are wrong in terms of proposing the justice of incentive inequalities, and what they think can rescue them, the basic structure objection, can't rescue them, because that itself is invalid, okay? And then, of course, there's a second point, and this gets us back to some of the things that we talked about before, which is, if that's all right, then what the basic structure debate tells us is that principles of justice should also apply to personal choices, informal institutions, all the sort of stuff that's missed by the Rawlsians, in a sense, okay? So, and then Jerry basically says justice, egalitarian justice, requires an egalitarian ethos. And that's the second conclusion to some extent, okay? So this, in a nutshell, just to put the context, is more or less what's going on in the first part. And I do emphasize, actually, the emphasis should be on the less, not on the more. I mean, there's much, much, much more going on than that. Many, many more complicated arguments. But that's the gist of it. Now, I think that poses a radical challenge for institutionalists, being the sort of people who like institutions, by definition. Okay. Stupid definition, but there you go. So here is the point. To some extent, Cohen's aim in what I was saying before, it's actually only to prevent the basic structure objection from, you know, countering his incentive inequality critique. But actually, along the way, he generally reduces the importance of social institutions. So even if he wouldn't want to do that, you know, it seems to be pretty much following from what he was saying. And so Jerry's perspective basically is the following, which is, and he's very explicit about this, say that his ultimate focus, for him, justice is really about a pattern of distribution of advantage and disadvantage. That's what we need to assess. And the immediate focus, you know, how do we do this? Well, we can do this by focusing on social institutions, the structure, or we can do this by focusing on social practices, ethos, not or, actually and, both of these are valid. So he's basically saying, I don't want to make a choice between ethos and structure, you know, all I care about is the patterns, whatever works, in a funny sort of way. Okay. However, if that is true, why should we care, really care, about institutions at all if the egalitarian ethos could also deliver justice? Okay. So Jerry says just society requires an egalitarian ethos. Without that, we have all these problems. And, you know, that's the sort of stuff what Joe was telling about before. So without an egalitarian ethos, he thinks injustice remains, inequality remains, unjust inequality remains. But if the egalitarian ethos is present, why are institutions still necessary? That's the question. Now, Cohen does actually have an argument, which he sort of mentions very briefly, and he calls it the enhancement features or the enhancement argument, where he basically says a private ethos enhances, not just supplement, public institutions. You know, so basically, we can have public institutions, but if we combine them with an egalitarian ethos, then they just work much better. So we have, you know, it all works much better in a general sort of sense. And the reason is that, you know, he mentions sort of things to do with information and coordination problems. Now, here is one problem that Jerry wouldn't be worried about this, okay? But people who like institutions a bit more might be worried by this, which is that the enhancement argument is a purely instrumental and a contingent one, and has no normative value beyond its outcome. Okay, so the idea really is that if all institutions are doing is just, you know, contribute to patterns, then, you know, the extent to which they do that, that's fine. If they don't do this, then fine as well. We just get rid of them. Okay, so in some sense, Cohen couldn't really care about the proper mix of, say, institutions and ethos in terms of which one really produces justice. Okay. And imagine, you know, I mean, in some sense, say, imagine two societies in which the same level of justice obtains in terms of, you know, distribution of advantage, disadvantage, equal, ideally. You know, the one is achieved by purely institutional justice. The other one is achieved by purely, say, egalitarian ethos, personal choices. I mean, Cohen basically says, well, I don't care. Each of these is perfectly valid. Each of these is equally fine. Okay. Now, what I would like to say is that committed institutionalists are simply uneasy about this. I mean, there's a sense in which a lot of institutionalists tend to think, and it's kind of a funny statement in some sense, because it's very hard to push institutionalists on why they really, really do think institutions matter so much. But there's a number of people who feel very uneasy, even if they accept everything that Cohen's saying, feel very uneasy that, you know, one implication is that institutions themselves don't really seem to matter all that much. So what I'd like to do, the question I have basically is, well, is there really nothing more we can say in favor of social institutions, even if we accept Cohen's arguments? Okay, I kind of have a proposal where institutions might have, there might be a different way of looking at institutions, which I think is ignored or somewhat neglected by Cohen, and which might actually have an impact beyond what he's been saying himself. And I'll say something briefly, as tentative as it gets again, on the sort of issues that arise in terms of egalitarian ethos after. Okay, so first of all, Rawls versus Cohen on the basic structure, okay? So the basic structure is meant to refer to formal institutions. Actually, Rawls says the most important ones, but, you know, and there's a sort of, you know, at various places, there's a list of institutions going on, but ultimately it remains fairly unclear why this particular list is supposed to go or not. And Rawls does offer a few definitions, which we'll go to in a minute. But the important bit is that this is really only about formal institutions. So informal institutions and practices and personal choices and ethos and those sort of things are outside of the definition. One small note, as I was actually, I sort of typed this up last evening and then sent it off to my colleague to print. And then I realized afterwards that one of the things struck me that, you know, Jerry often works with a very binary approach. I mean, there's the basic structure and there's the ethos. But I'm kind of wondering whether what we really don't want is a sort of a triplicate of, you know, formal institutions, basic structure on the one hand, informal institutions, and then really personal choices. And I think one of the reasons is because Jerry seems to think that, you know, ultimately, if we all make our personal choices, that itself constitutes an informal institution. And I think from an institutional perspective, that's wrong, because first of all, it wouldn't constitute all informal institutions necessarily. There might be other ones. And secondly, the very idea that in a sense, informal institutions, it's true that informal institutions don't really exist unless people behave in a certain way. There's a very strong connection there. But whether or not that means we have to totally think them as encapsulated by people's behavior, I have my doubts about that. But I haven't really thought through this sort of distinction properly. But I kind of think that there's something missing there. So to some extent, I'd like to talk about the tree, about personal behavior, informal institutions as separate from behavior and formal institutions, okay? But accepting that, in some sense, Jerry might disagree with that, okay? So to understand the importance of the basic structure as a restricted site of social justice, I think we need to understand two things. We need to be absolutely clear how to define it conceptually, what sets out these institutions from the other ones, but also normatively, what, if anything, gives us the reason to think that what we set out is important in the first place, okay? And to some extent, what Jerry has done in looking at Rawls is to argue, well, you know, actually, they don't fit in the Rawlsian framework, so they just get separated out, okay? So let's look at a couple of candidates here. So one of the things that Rawls says is that, you know, the basic structure is important because they're present from the start. I'm going to, with 20 minutes done already? Whoa, fast. I'm going to have to speed up now. Okay. So the present from the start thing, Jerry thinks is totally implausible and irrelevant. And I think that's absolutely right. If you really think that, you know, sort of the fact that you were born in a particular institution is only what matters. I mean, here's a stupid example. I mean, imagine the Belgians invade Canada tomorrow. You know, I mean, it would follow that for most of us, this would not be a basic structure. But then someone's born after the invasion suddenly becomes a basic structure. I mean, that seems slightly odd. There is another sense, of course, in which you can, a more general sense or more charitable sense, in which you can interpret present from the start, and that's simply to say that institutions are outside of us and in some sense are there in an important sort of sense. And that one, as vague as it is, I think is a little bit more handy, but it actually doesn't help us in terms of clarifying what is precisely the basic structure, okay? Secondly is the big one, the profound effects criterion, which is relevant, but then according to Cohen, and I think he's right, can't make the necessary distinctions. So the profundity of effect gives us the reason why we should care about some things more than others. The more effect on justice, the more we should care. Because, you know, I mean, face it, we can have all these trivial institutions that don't really impact on us. So, you know, clearly we want to leave those out. There's a couple of questions, I think, about profundity of effect, and I'm just going to mention them because I think Jerry doesn't really discuss them, nor does Rawls, and they, you know, they might have an impact. The first one is it's not entirely clear what profound effects are meant to be affected upon, and there might be different. I mean, even within a Rawlsian framework, I mean, do we think that an effect on primary goods is what matters? Do we think an effect on, say, the moral powers matters? I mean, there could be different things going on. Okay. And the second problem is different institutions, strictly speaking. I mean, if you step away from this idea of the basic structure and you look at the institutions within the basic structure, you could imagine different institutions having different impacts on different dimensions of it. And that leads us to all sorts of trade-offs and so on. Thirdly, there is the idea that even if something matters, it doesn't tell us necessarily how we respond to that. Now, what Jerry is right in pointing out is that the Rawlsians, in a sense, ignore that other things than the basic structure have a profound effect. Therefore, the criterion seems to be very, very odd. But it doesn't tell us how we should respond to that. And one big difference is we could respond to it directly, as Jerry proposes, in terms of the egalitarian ethos. But we could also respond to it, in some sense, by taking what happens outside of it that have profound effects as information in terms of design of the actual formal institutions. And this is the strategy I'll actually propose later on. I'll say something more about that. A fourth problem then is that profundity of effect is often characterized as a binary issue. You know, you either have profound effects or not. And this seems blatantly wrong. I mean, you know, something has more profound effects than less. And that leads to big discussions about how far do you want to go with this. And it just means that this, as a criterion conceptually, sort of, you know, moves things along quite importantly. And of course, to some extent, Jerry uses that as a strategy to argue that, you know, this really is what makes social practices and the ethos important as opposed to merely the basic structure. So he then uses this as an argument to say that's what creates a dilemma in the first place. The Rawlsians basically, if they think profound effect is that important, you know, then to some extent, conceptually and normatively, they need to move things along. Now, Jerry proposes another definition, a possible definition, which says that, well, if profound effects can't really do it, perhaps legally coercive institutions can do it. So, you know, to some extent, we could simply argue that formal institutions, conceptually, because they are embedded in legal coercion, allow us to distinguish the basic structure from informal ones and from choices. But then the question is, do they have normative content as such? Jerry seems to think not, because the profound effect is supposed to generate things. There's a couple of questions about this, though. I mean, a number of people might actually argue, well, the fact that, you know, particular institutions are tied in with legal coercion does give particular normative content as well, okay? So in some sense, there's questions about whether we don't move too fast about that. I don't necessarily want to make a big point about this as such. One point I want to make is, if you actually read these passages of Jerry's book, it's very obviously the case that for Cohen, this whole sort of legal coercion criterion is very much a red herring, right? I mean, it's not that he's really putting a dilemma where people can go either or. Basically, what he wants people to impale themselves on a very specific one, which then ultimately leads us to accepting profundity of effect as the really big criterion and basically, you know, arguing that social practices and so on should be part of it as well. So it is really, it's not like, you know, feel free to go left or right. It is, please do go left and impale yourself on this particular kinds of dilemma. So there is a little, you know, I mean, when you read this, you have to keep in mind that there's a very, very specific goal going on here, right? So, I mean, so leaving these, so this is Rawls versus Cohen at the moment. What I would propose is to look at social institutions in a slightly different way. This is going to take another 5 minutes. Is that okay?
5 minutes.
Okay. Which is actually the following. Imagine that social institutions, in some sense, are a human product of a very peculiar type. In the following sense, they are they have an impact on agents individually. We know this. And actually, I have a whole section on the sort of impacts they have in terms of information precision, assurance, self-binding, which is the question that you put, but also in terms of coercion. And the difference between self-binding and coercion is simply in terms of whether you agree, in a sense, in the first place. It's not in terms of the whole sort of actions that we put forward. I mean, imagine you could be coerced in say, for example, a Thaler-Schoenstein kind of nudge sense, where, you know, there's not much physical coercion going on, but the very fact that the institutions put a default, which you haven't agreed with, in some sense counts as coercion in this sort of sense. So there's all sorts of ways in which institutions impact on individuals. But here is another one, which is that social institutions are actually also produced, but they are produced collectively, okay? A single individual can be impacted by an institution, but a single individual cannot produce an institution, okay? For that, we need to have a group, a collective sort of thing. And the impact of these two, and the point about the impact I mentioned is that we actually have a distributive issue here, because, you know, different impact on individuals means this is clearly a distributional issue. The point about collective production is that, you know, this raises issues in terms of responsibilities we might have in terms of design. So what I would like to argue basically is the following. Social institutions are analytically separate from individual agents, but not from agents collectively. So they exist insofar as agents collectively interact with and reinforce institutions. This means agents collectively impact on social institutions, not social institutions just on agents. They are genuine human products. And the ways in which agents impact on social institutions is, of course, very complex and multidimensional. So what, if anything, is special about institutions? What could we say about this? Well, I have five propositions, and I'm going to have to run through them fairly fast, but we can pick up some of the points as we go. Because agents are individually impacted and in turn collectively have an impact on social institutions, this actually means that agents in some impact upon each other, mediated through institutions. Fairly straightforward, obvious. Well, after what Joe was saying, I'm reluctant to say obvious, because I know it's going to bite me in the backside, but you know, I would have thought this is an obvious point. Now, because agents can only collectively impact on social institutions, what we require is a collective approach, a coordinated approach, a principle of coordination, and a principle of just coordination, i.e. a principle that delivers just outcomes. Now, Here's an important one. Formal and informal institutions differ considerably in terms of how one can directly coordinate institutional change. Formal institutions can be designed in a much more straightforward, direct way than informal institutions. This kind of gets us back to all this business about how do we change informal institutions if they are so embedded with behavior and so on and so forth. You know, what are the anchors? What are the mechanisms? Okay. Fourth point, collective responsibility, although it imperfectly tracks design capacity, suggests that we have to have a direct normative focus on formal institutions in some sense. Okay, it's because of the design component, nothing to do with coercion or profundity of effect and so on. It's because, in some sense, formal institutions allow us to design that the just outcomes. That, in some sense, warrants a more direct focus. Informal institutions and anything to do with that serve as parametric input. They are the sort of information we take into account. We agree that they have profound effects, but you know, in some sense, we design the formal institutions taking into account what happens at the level of informal institutions. This is how institutionalists think about this sort of stuff in a fairly, again, straightforward sense. And because informal social institutions is a crucial background condition, the design of formal institutions must take into account ways to promote a supportive ethos for achieving social justice more effectively. So to some extent, this gets us back to one of the issues that Cohen has had, and I guess a lot of the issues that you talk about in your work, Joe, which is that, you know, the fact that we focus on formal institutions doesn't mean, it actually means that we don't have to ignore ethos in two ways. First of all, we take them into account as background condition anyway. Secondly, we also use formal institutions to change informal institutions. Okay, that's how partly how the direction works in from a design sort of perspective. So, and I'll literally do this in 1 minute. I'm going to skip the ethos thing. This will be one more minute. If this argument is sound, what I'm actually talking about is a sort of a capacity for institutional design approach towards institution, which could offer resources for, one, I think, relevant conceptual distinctions between formal and informal institutions. You know, we can, to some extent, really, we have the conceptual toolkit to distinguish particular institutions, more or less. I mean, there are some mixed cases. Secondly, we have relevant and, I think, fairly robust normative arguments for directly focusing on formal social institutions as the appropriate site of social justice at the rules of regulation level. So, you know, this is not about the principle level. This is, why do we focus on social justice? Well, because, you know, we can design, you know, therefore we have certain responsibilities there which seem to be different from the informal ones that we have. Thirdly, a genuine normative argument. We also have a genuine normative argument for not excluding informal social institutions. This is different from the Rawlsian basic structure thing, from consideration at all. But instead, we're giving them some appropriate place within considerations of institutional design. So, you know, against the Rawlsians, although actually Rawls himself, as per usual, you know, has a few squeezy bits in between at various places, which I'm not sure about. And fourthly, none of this compromises on justice in principle by virtue of arbitrarily restricting the application of the principle, because ultimately, you know, a sort of a Cohenite conception of justice in terms of a pattern is still what drives all this. Okay, so the big difference between this sort of type of idea, as vague and as tentative as it is, and a sort of a Rawlsian approach is that, you know, you don't have to give up on the pattern conception at all. You just, you know, tweak things around in a slightly different way. But you do still have an important focus on social justice. On formal institutions. And I'll leave the bit on ethos and duties and things and see where that comes in questions. That's it. Sorry. Thank you.
Questions?
I wonder if we could situate this debate between Rawls and Cohen back in time. Like between like the 1953 Rawls and 1978 Cohen, because it seems like actually there's something, there's a lineage here, because in the original justice as fairness essay, Rawls defined practices there as rule bound or rule governed, right? And equates them therefore with precisely institutions. Mm-hmm. Practices are institutions because they are rule bound. But it seems like one of the things that Cohen did in his early work on Marx, and maybe this just continues to have its repercussions right up into his latest work, is to precisely say that rules don't govern practices, practices govern rules, right? What rules we have are explained by their functionality for the practices that we engage in. So I wonder if there's just there's a very basic disagreement between Rawlsians and Cohenites over whether or not rules actually govern action or not. If you think they do, then of course paying attention to institutions is going to make sense. If they don't, if you think that that's not true, then your attention is going to be drawn elsewhere. Your attention is going to be drawn to sort of a ground-up approach, something like that.
I mean, I think there's basically two replies to this. The first one is Cohen, in the most recent work, acknowledges both directions. And in a sense, he wants to emphasize and say that no, practices do determine what happens at the level of rules. But he's not dismissing the fact that rules determine partly what happens at the level of practices, okay? So as a sort of an explanatory thing, you know, he accepts both, and he accepts that this is very complicated. But then, and this is the second answer, he immediately basically says, well, you know, that's the level of rules of regulation. I'm interested in the level of principles of justice. And then he says, look, ultimately, what goes wrong with the Rawlsians is basically to say, well, you know, rules determine practices, but, you know, if there are particular limits to what rules can do, then well, fine, rules is what delivers us justice, and that's it. You know, as long, and he has all these sort of little bits, really interesting bits in the book, where he basically says, well, you know, for a Rawlsian, you know, once we have the basic structure sorted and we have our principles, you can behave in between that, and any outcome is by definition just. And that's the bit he disputes, and rightly so, by saying that, you know, ultimately what happens at the level of choice and practices matters for justice. At the level of rules of regulation, again, one thing that's to be said, and this is where I think a design perspective can be interesting, is that we can accept that rules determine practices, practices determine rules. But then the question is how, you know, we have a balance there. We have polycentricity in a sense. So what is the one that we can directly impact on? This is my point. Well, to say to people that, well, you know, it would be nice if we all had egalitarian ethos. I mean, changing an egalitarian ethos is not the most straightforward, obvious thing, partly because it's uncoordinated, partly because it takes time, also the psychological, sociological things. And that does not dismiss all the things that happens in terms of education and things like that. If anything, you know, things like education and what happens in schools and so on and so forth are institutions that determine how we change our practices. So, to me, that means that, you know, there's a sense in which we can focus in a very normative sense and have particular obligations to focus on institutions, precisely because we realize that they impact on social practices and because we realize that social practices themselves are fairly important to determine what happens at the final level of justice, sort of at the bar of justice, as Jerry would say. So, I think to some extent, some of that is implicit in the book, but I think I think at the level of regulations, in a sense, this stuff needs to be brought out much more. Much more work needs to be done.
Can I just follow up very quickly? Because, well, I mean, aren't you open to the objection then that, well, right, but we don't change rules by rules, right? That is, there has to be some sort of practice of changing the rules, and that practice of changing the rules is not itself a rule-bound practice, is it? I mean, maybe for Rawlsians it is. I don't know.
Right. Well, I'm kind of wondering to what extent that. I mean, in some sense you're right, but there's a sort of, you know, there's a probability of sort of infinite regress going on. Like, I mean, what's the fundamental kind of point at which we decide? I mean, ultimately, the bottom line is, like, if no one in society or no critical mass of society is motivated to change anything, none of this is going to follow, right? I think that's fine. Up to some extent. The question is, if we think, I mean, to some extent, this is really moving from ideal theory to non-ideal theory, and maybe this is getting into your territory, the paper there, but it's the idea of what do we accept at the non-ideal T bacterial level in terms of input? Well, one of the things you have to accept is that not everyone necessarily has the required sort of ethos, the required sort of convictions. You may accept that there is a critical mass of people who want to change things, accept particular sort of obligations, and then what is it that they can do? Well, one of the arguments you might want to put, and Cohen to some extent flirts with that considerably, despite, you know, I mean, this is all his arguments about coercion. Well, you might want to argue that perhaps we are legitimately justified in coercing people who don't believe in justice in accepting certain institutions, because one, they don't have the ethos to do things themselves according to the principle of justice. Therefore, institutions will do it for them or will, you know, restrict their choices. And they actually don't have any reason to object to that, because the only reasons that are admissible are the ones that would be in terms of justice. And if they don't accept these reasons, they can't put forward any reasons, then perhaps this is it. So there's different ways of floating with that. At the bottom line, of course, you have to have a starting point. If that's your view, then sure. But does that mean that everyone has to be this? No. Does that mean that we can't acknowledge particular obligations? I don't think so either. So
I have a question about, I mean, when I read the book, the first, and I have to admit, only time that I've read it. It's a big book. Right? It's a big book. I found that the dilemma, I mean, Jerry's prose has this quality, which is that he writes so clearly that he carries conviction sometimes beyond what the argument actually takes you, because it's so well written that you think something this clearly written has to be right. And so I found myself sort of doubling back on the dilemma and thinking, well, hold on a second, you know, is this dilemma actually as, you know, is there no space for anybody to get out in the horns of the dilemma? And, you know, I think that there's a fairly straightforward Rawlsian response to the dilemma, which is to say, you know, I refuse horn A and horn B by saying that if a society is, now we're in ideal theory, we're all the way up in ideal theory, right? All ideal Rawlsian theory. If a society is well ordered by the principles of justice, if the basic structure of a society is well ordered by the principles of justice. Now, we have to take a second to realize just how, you know, that's not a banal requirement. That's a lot of stuff is going on, right? That makes that society very different from what we have, you know, here, or, you know, even in the most just sort of, you know, Norway or something. If a society is well ordered by principles of justice, then there is nothing that we can do to one another within the informal or personal interactions that we have that will count as deep impact or profound effect, right? Now there's the family, which is, as Rawls himself acknowledges, is a big, big, big problem, right? Because it's hard for, you know, the family is an institution, it's deep impact, and it's hard for the state to get in there, and there are reasons that we want, you know, the state not to get in there, right? So putting the family aside, and that might be a big, you know, concession, aside from that, isn't it just the definition of well-orderedness that it makes it the case that there's nothing that we can do to one another that will count as deep impact? Now, it could be that we can't get there, right? I mean, you know, it could be that that's too tall an order, as it were, but it just seems to me to be denying something very fundamental about what Rawls means by well-orderedness, to say that he's impaled, that the Rawlsians are sort of impaled on one or the other horns of that very crisply phrased dilemma.
I mean, to some extent, this kind of boils down on two things. So first of all, is this whole business about, you know, how determinate or indeterminate is this whole business with the difference principle, right? Now, if you're saying under your particular scenario, then what you're saying, not only is it fairly determinate, but also it's determinate in the right sort of egalitarian sense, and therefore Jerry wouldn't find that much to object with, right? Is that
what is the it?
Sir?
It is
it being, I guess, well, in a very strict sense, incentive inequalities which might be justified through the difference principle, which is, and you know, in that sort of sense is very, very strict sort of focus, right? The other thing about the whole thing about Rawls and a well-ordered society, of course, is that, I mean, there's a sense in which ethos gets smuggled into that in a very important sense as well.
It's not even smuggled, it's there, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, in a very sort of obvious sense. So if one way in which you might want to argue is simply to say that, well, roles in well-ordered society is the basic structure and a lot of other stuff, which is precisely what Cohen basically says we should be doing as well. So, I mean, I'm kind of wondering whether, to some extent, and Rawlsians have been trying to make this sort of argument, but I think what Cohen specifically would say is that just doesn't seem to fit with some other bits that Rawls, in theory, is saying, and that he's trying to impale them on. So, but one of, I mean, to be honest, this is where one of the problems I have with pinning a lot of this on Rawls is that, you know, there's a lot of work there as well, and it does seem to be shifts and arguments going back and forth. So I'm not sure whether that fully resolves the dilemma or not.
So Peter wants to come in right on this point, and then Pablo.
Just a quick point about the way in which an ethos is actually already present in the Rawlsian structure. I think we might be facing a problem here similar to the one to the efficiency properties of the market, right? I mean, if we're in a well-ordered society, then through the sense of justice that is developed on a reciprocal basis, there is indeed that well-orderedness. But since the sense of justice is precisely based on that reciprocity, as soon as there's some injustice in the society, the reciprocity shoots in an unpredictable way.
Yeah.
So, you know, the second best, just as in
sure.
with efficient markets, might not be getting closer to the justice, but it's something that we simply know nothing about. So if we're not in the well-ordered society, getting closer to the well-ordered society might not actually be justice-enhancing.
Two quick comments. The first is that I'm not fully sure that, you know, whether you disagree with Cohen in any way, really.
Sorry?
I'm not sure that you disagree with Cohen in any significant way.
No, and I didn't mean to.
Okay, so, it seems to me that you accept that justice judgments should range over ethos besides structures, formal or informal, and that they should do so because paying attention to what has a pervasive impact on people's levels of advantage, however the metric of advantage is. Or perhaps there is some element that you are adding here that, let me just volunteer a point and see where you agree. Because you say you were emphasizing the importance of institutions, and you are adding to Cohen in the sense that you are explaining why institutions are so important, no? Even if you are agreeing with him that they are not the only things that are important, but you are explaining why they are important, and he seems not to have noticed. Yeah, the way in which they are important that you are presenting, so that's clearly an addition. But something that you added, I think also is interesting, is that the criterion for what counts as the side of justice is not just pervasive impact, but the extent to which we can have an impact on that which has impact, right? And we this goes connected with what you said, that we can't change institutions or design them in a way in which we cannot design or change. And I think this is an important point, right? To make a distinction between what has an impact on people's levels of advantage and what we as agents here and now can affect, right? Have an impact on. Say, the laws of physics have a lot of impact on people's levels.
Two quick comments. Well, first of all, I mean, about the disagreement with Cohen. I mean, the point of the paper, and I should have been more explicit about this, or the point of the presentation, was really to see, okay, Cohen says all this stuff at the level of ideal theory, principles of justice. What, to some extent, can we do when we move the next step down? And in many ways, it was quite interesting to see how much you can get on the institutional level, even agreeing with a lot of things that Cohen says. But it does require a little bit different work, and it raises different sort of issues, one of which you've mentioned. Now, one of the things about the difference between, I mean, the way you're putting it is interesting, what has impact and what we can impact in the sense of what agents can impact. Well, I mean, Jerry, of course, makes that distinction and basically, in some extent, says, well, that's precisely why, you know, people are under an obligation in the egalitarian justice ethos to do certain things. I mean, even if in the final analysis we might excuse them, we might not want to blame them. There's sort of interesting bits where, you know, he says, well, we might not necessarily have to blame agents because there might be all sorts of other reasons why. But, you know, if a particular thing is a requirement of justice, then, you know, presumably agents have, you know, a particular sort of duty to do this, in particular if they can have an impact at various of ways. I guess the key point here, and this is where a lot more work needs to be done, is why certain of these obligations would be specifically collective. And here is one thought, of course. This kind of ties in with a more Rawlsian point as well, which is that, I mean, a lot of what Cohen says works to the extent that we have full agreement on a particular conception of justice and so on and so forth. Now, you relax that assumption in the real world, and we got all these issues to do with different conceptions of justice, how to mediate this, and so on and so forth. And one interesting thing, of course, is when we think about the design of institutions, is that that brings that much, much more out in the open. You know, so to some extent, there's normative debates there to be had about what precisely are the principles that we guide, how do we do this, and so on and so forth, and how far we can do these obligations, you know, how much coercion is allowed, and so on and so forth, based on that. So it does open a whole nest of different considerations, for sure. So.